In our introduction to the Ten Commandments, we saw the context of the commandments. They were given to a people who had much to thank God for. They had been released from their slavery in Egypt and were heading for a land that God would give them, a land flowing with milk and honey. It would be their own land. And God, of course, had a right to give it to them. And then we saw the communication of the commandments. And we've reminded ourselves of that in our reading from Deuteronomy chapter 5. They were given by the voice of God, not simply to Moses, but to all the people of God. And then God confirmed them in writing by what we understand as his own finger on tablets of stone. They were unique. We saw the covenant of the commandments. They were the framework of laws, of codes and principles by which the people of God were to live. They were their guidelines. And then we saw the continuance of the commandments. They were given not just for the Israelites, but also for all people for all time. They reveal what God expects from us. And though their existence shows us that we cannot live up to them, just try. We cannot live up to them. We cannot live up to God's standard. We must at least try. There must be some effort instead of just saying, I can't do it, and sitting back and doing what we like. Well, because we cannot keep the Ten Commandments as God requires, it means that we cannot gain our own salvation by the keeping of them. But the point is this: once we have salvation through Jesus Christ, we can show that we have that salvation by attempting at least to keep these commandments. We also saw that Jesus himself gives us a greater understanding of these commandments. And then we noted what I've already said this morning, that it's generally thought that the first of these commandments, the first four, speak of our relationship to God. And this morning, we begin to look at these by focusing our attention on the first of those commandments found in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 3 and Deuteronomy chapter 5 and verse 7. You shall have no gods before me. As we look at these commandments, I want us to notice three things. The first of which is this: we all need a God. Now, you may be sitting there, you may be thinking to yourself, I don't need a God. And there are thousands, millions of people out there, trillions of people out there who say to themselves, I don't need a God. But when the crunch comes, or we don't have to even have to come to a crunch, we just have to come to an understanding. When we come to an understanding, we will discover that each and every person on this earth has a God. And they need a God. Why do I say this? I say this because there is within man a need for religion. There is a need to worship. There is a need for a God or gods. Man's makeup is such that even the most primitive of people needs a God. And that's proven. It's proven throughout history. This is no new thought. It's one that has been around for a long time. Plutarch, he was a Greek essayist and a Greek philosopher. He was around in the first and second centuries AD. And he said this. If you go round the world, you may find cities without walls, or literature, or kings, or houses, or wealth, or money, without gymnasia or theatres. But no one ever saw a city without temples and gods, one which does not have recourse to prayers or oaths or oracles, which does not offer sacrifice to obtain blessings or celebrate rites to avert evil. Nowhere on earth will you find such a place. Much more recently, towards the end of the 18th century, the politician and religious thinker Edmund Burke put it this way: man is by constitution a religious animal. Man is by his makeup a religious animal. And just one more quote from the Roman writer Cicero puts these two together as he writes some 50 years or so before the coming of Christ, and therefore before Plutarch and Burke. He says this: there is no people so wild and savage as not to have believed in a God, even if they have been unacquainted with his nature. It is necessary to believe that there are gods, because we have an implanted, or rather innate, knowledge of them. In other words, says Cicero, we are religious. We have a desire to worship, and we need a God because it's born in us. So does this surprise us? If so, it shouldn't. And the reason it shouldn't surprise us is because the Bible tells us that man was created in the image of God. Man was created to worship God. So the question comes, why don't people worship him? And the reason is simple. It's because since the fall in the Garden of Eden, we've departed from him. And the further away man has gone, the more gods he's invented. You only have to look at it logically. Here is the one true and supreme God, and Adam and Eve worshipped him. They had no need of any other gods. But the moment they came out of the Garden of Eden because they sinned against him, then the further away they got from God, and the further away from they got from God, the more gods they needed. I quoted a Greek and Roman, and they perhaps above all knew what gods were about. Their gods abounded. Stacks of them. The Romans believed that every part of their lives was controlled not by one god, but by many gods. They had gods for everything and anything. Gods for the crops, gods for gates, gods for homes, gods for light, for love, for war, for water, even for the drains. Anything and everything they had a God for. In actual fact, the Romans were great. They had a hierarchy of gods. It was a God at the top, and then gradually the lesser gods. So you made sure, first of all, that you appeased that God. Paul went in Greece, Athens to be precise, commented on their altar. It was to an unknown God. The These were supposedly civilized society, these Romans and these Greeks. But when it comes to what... But they had all these unknown gods. All these known gods, and then this one unknown god, just in case we've missed one out. But when it comes to what we might term the uncivilized societies, what about them? The same applies. They too had their gods of the sun, the moon, the wood, the fire, the river, and so on. As we read the scriptures, we see these many gods of man's making. But in addition to the many gods of man's making, there is another God. The God that we've been looking at, the God that we've been worshipping. He's not a God of man's making, but the God who is the maker of men, the maker of women, the maker of mankind. And here in the first commandment, we find that it should not be that we all need a God. That's true. But more fundamental to this is this point: we all need the God. In Exodus chapter 20 and verse 2, God said something quite tremendous. And on reflection, quite awe-inspiring. He said, "I am the Lord your God." And it's in the light of this that he says in the first commandment, "You shall have no other gods before me." What is God saying here? God is saying here that he's available. He's available to every believer. Some of you may know the name of Dr. Peter Masters from the Metropolitan Tabernacle. He says about this commandment in effect says, "I will be so good and gracious to you. I will be so approachable by you. I will be such a father, savior, and friend to you that you will need no other God beside me. You can come to me, love me, feel my presence, and receive my forgiveness, life, and power. You can share in my eternal purpose and be my child, and I will be your God forever." All that is inherent in this commandment. He will be our God, and all this flows from it. One of the problems that many people have with the Ten Commandments is that we see only a list which says, "You shall not." And we look at them far too negatively. We need to look at the positive aspect of these commandments as well. And here is one of them: that this God, the God, wants to be our God. The question very often, though, is this: do I want this God to be my God? Who is anyway? Most of us don't need to ask this question, but somebody may. Or it may be that some ought not only to be asking it, but also finding out who this God really is. And those of us who know who God is ought to be reminding ourselves of it constantly. When God told Moses to go to Egypt to ask Pharaoh to let the people go, "Let my people go," Moses was troubled by a number of things, one of which was the Israelite response to his message. So he said to God in Exodus chapter 3 and verse 13, "Suppose I go to the Israelites and I say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his name?' Then what shall I tell them?" To which God replied, "I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. This God who says, I want to be your God, who says, you can approach me, you can rely on me, and who says, you shall have no other gods before me, is the great I am. The great creator God, the great sustainer God, the great ruler of the universe God, the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. He is everything. He is the Almighty. He is the unchanging God. And this God says to you, you shall have no other gods before me. You don't need any other gods. And what he had just said to the Israelites in Exodus 20 and verse 2 was this. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. Their coming out of Egypt, out of slavery, had nothing whatsoever to do with the gods of the Egyptians or any other gods that the Israelites had been worshipping. It was all done by the power of God, who now says, in effect, you need only me. We were looking at the final verses of Amos on Wednesday evening in our prayer, in our Bible study. And we noted there the way the children of Israel had forgotten who God really was. They looked at their coming out of Egypt, not in the terms of the Ten Commandments, not in terms of the fact that their God was the one who led them out and brought them into this wonderful new land. They were just like other nations who had come from other lands. They had allowed themselves to become like everybody else. We're not to do that. And that's what we do when we forget our salvation, when we forget what God has done for us. We become just like other people. This God who wanted to be their God was the God who had done great things for them, who's done great things for us, hasn't he? And this God wants to be our God too, for he's still the same unchanging God, and he has done greater things for us than he did for them. For he's given us a way through Christ, whereby we can be freed not from physical slavery, but from spiritual slavery. He is taking us not to a new country as he was the Israelites, a new country on earth, but to a new country in heaven. This is the God who wants to be our God. This is God we need to have. Is he our God? We all need a God. We all need the God. And finally, we all need the God alone. When we have this God, we need no other. Indeed, we must have no other, for this God commands us quite clearly, quite categorically, you shall have no other gods before me. Now that creates a problem, doesn't it? What does this phrase before me mean? Does it mean that I can have all sorts of God behind him? No, it doesn't. If you've got an NIV, you will notice that the NIV margin tells us that it means, or could mean, besides. You shall have no other gods beside me. In other words, we can't be like the Romans. We can't be like the Romans who had Jupiter as their supreme god and commander, and then numerous other gods below. We must appease Jupiter first, but then we can appease all these other gods. We can worship all these other gods. The command God gives is that he shall be our one and only God. But of course, like many other commands of God, it's far easier to say than to obey. We know, don't we, that not long after the giving of this command. Moses was on the mountain receiving more commands from God, along with the written Ten Commandments. And at the same time, down the mountain, the impatient, fickle people had gathered round Aaron and were saying in the words of Exodus 32 and verse 1, "Come, make us gods who will go before us. Make us gods we can see." And when that god in the form of a calf had been made, they said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt." What a load of rubbish. But this epitomized the attitude of the children of Israel throughout the whole of the Old Testament. There were times when they realized that their God was the only God and the only one to be worshipped. But they were few and far between. There were far more times when they allowed other gods to come into their lives. And very little has changed. For just like the Israelites, we find this commandment easy to say, but very difficult to obey. Our problem, to some extent, are not the problems of the Israelites, for the other gods they had were very often easy to see. For example, the god of Dagon, the fish god. We come back to the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant went into the temple of Dagon, didn't it? Remember that story? Went into the temple of Dagon. The following day, Dagon was on the floor. They righted him. The next day they went in, his head was missing. They soon got rid of the ark. And we can see the statues of Nebuchadnezzar and so on. These people and these things that were to be worshipped, they could be seen. But today, we don't worship such gods normally. We're not ecumenical in the fact that we don't worship Allah or Buddha or the Guru. But is that an end of it? Or is there something or someone else we have as a god today? Is there something or someone in my life that I put before God? Or that I put on a par with him or even just behind him? Is there something or someone in my life that adversely affects the way I worship God? These all come under the category of other gods. And they come in all shapes and all forms. They may be possessions, career, business, children, home, clothes, hobbies, electronic gadgets, TV, entertainment, sport, relationships, pop stars, or a host of other things. What is that thing that when I hear about it makes me say, "I must be there"? Is it a pop concert? Is it a sporting event? Is it some concert? Is it something else other than God? Other than the worship of God? These things are okay. There are, generally speaking, no problems with many of these things that we enjoy. The problem comes when those things that we enjoy come in front of God. These things become wrong when they dominate our lives. They become other gods. And that goes against the first commandment. We all need the God only. He must take first place in our lives. Everything else comes after him and doesn't replace him in any way. We all need a God. We are creatures whose inmost being needs a God. Do you know this need? Who is your God to be? We all need the God. There is at the end of the day one God and one God only who can satisfy our needs. One God and one God only through whom we can gain salvation. This is the God we all need. He is approachable and he wants to be your God. Is he? We all need the God only. We do not need, nor will God allow us to have any God but him. Is God having to fight his way into your life? Then listen to the words of Joshua in Joshua 24 and verse 14. Now fear the Lord and serve him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods your forefathers worshipped beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your forefathers served beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. And may your response and mine be this. The same response of these as the Israelites. Far be it from us to forsake the Lord to serve other gods. So remembering those words, also remember the words of the first commandment. You shall have no other gods before me.